So knowing the history really does matter.
Knowing the history matters.
Phil had mentioned that the Kentucky case in 1980, Stone v. Graham, after 191 years of having the Ten Commandments in classrooms, the Stone v. Graham court said we're not doing that anymore. Now, as Matt mentioned, that's been dumped now, that limit test is gone. But this is actually what was hanging in the Kentucky classrooms. That is the Stone v. Graham. This was given me by a legislator from Kentucky who passed that initial bill. And so the bill that Phil has introduced reflects this. And as it describes the Ten Commandments, this is what was hanging in the Kentucky classrooms. And as Phil mentioned, this looks exactly like what we have on the Capitol grounds. This is traditional historical stuff, and that meets the test that the court has now given us for what can be done. So it's hard to say that anything's more traditional in American education than was the Ten Commandments, going back to the very first textbook and going up through the 20th century.
That was David Barton testifying before the Texas Senate Education Committee in 2023. The Supreme Court case Barton referred to, Stone versus Graham, decided in 1980 that the method of displaying the Ten Commandments in Kentucky classrooms was an establishment of religion and therefore a violation of the First Amendment. Over two decades later, McCurry County, Kentucky schools made another attempt to include the Ten Commandments in schools, which provoked a challenge from the American Civil Liberties Union. In McCurry County versus ACLU, the Supreme Court of 2005 found that McCurry County's method of using the Ten Commandments was distinctly religious, and to a reasonable person, gave the appearance of establishing religion in violation of the First Amendment. Two contrasting views of the separation of church and state were on display in McCurry County. Justice David Souter wrote and delivered the majority opinion on June 27, 2005. Here's a short clip of Souter's presentation.
Finally, a word needs to be said about the dissent in this case. The dissent calls for jettisoning decades of precedent adhering to the neutrality principle to return what it believes to be the framers' understanding of the Establishment Clause. But the dissent's account of history is not compelling and certainly not sufficient to overrule 60 years of precedent recognizing government neutrality as an objective of the Establishment Clause. While the dissent cites evidence showing that some framers, like our first president, included religious references in official speech, there is evidence that equally prominent figures like Jefferson and Madison believed that references to be forbidden under the Establishment Clause. And if the history of official religious acknowledgement is too murky to justify departing from our neutrality precedents, then the new rule that the dissent derives from history should quicken our resolve to stick with precedent. For the dissent would allow the government to espouse and acknowledge the core religious beliefs of some religious faiths, those that are monotheistic but not others. While some members of this court have argued that the Establishment Clause forbids only discrimination among religious sects but not between religion and irreligion, this is the first time the view has been advanced that the government may favor some religions but not others. We think that this view flies in the face of the neutrality the framers thought necessary to prevent the religious strife with which they were all too familiar. As for us, we are centuries away from St. Bartholomew's Day massacre and from the treatment of heretics in early Massachusetts. But the divisiveness in religion in current public life is indisputable. This is no time to turn our back on a principle of neutrality that has served religious liberty and freedom of conscience so well. Justice O'Connor has filed a concurring opinion. Justice Scalia will announce the dissenting opinion.
Then, in his dissent, Justice Antonin Scalia presented a view which may sound familiar.
That is one model of the relationship between church and state, a model spread across Europe by the armies of Napoleon and reflected in the Constitution of France, which begins, "France is a secular republic. Religion is strictly excluded from the public forum." That is not and never was the model adopted by America. George Washington added to the form of presidential oath prescribed by Article 2 of the Constitution the concluding words, "So help me God." The Supreme Court under John Marshall opened its sessions with the prayer, "God save the United States and this honorable court." The first Congress instituted the practice of beginning its legislative sessions with a prayer. The same week that Congress submitted the Establishment Clause as part of the Bill of Rights for ratification by the states, it enacted legislation providing for paid chaplains in the House and Senate. The day after the First Amendment was proposed, the same Congress that had proposed it requested the President to proclaim, quote, "a day of public thanksgiving and prayer to be observed by acknowledging with grateful hearts the many and signal favors of Almighty God." With all of this reality and much more staring it in the face, how can the Court possibly assert, as it does in today's opinion, that, and I quote, "the First Amendment mandates governmental neutrality between religion and non-religion," and that, quote, "manifesting a purpose to favor adherence to religion generally is unconstitutional"? Who says so? Surely not the words of the Constitution. Surely not the history and traditions that reflect our society's constant understanding of those words. Surely not even the current sense of American society. Nothing stands behind the Court's assertion that governmental affirmation of America's belief in God is unconstitutional except the Court's own say-so.
In the 5-4 decision, one of the votes to strike down Kentucky's use of the Ten Commandments in schools was cast by Sandra Day O'Connor. In a separate concurring opinion, she posed a shrewd question. Quote, "Those who would renegotiate the boundaries between church and state must therefore answer a difficult question. Why would we trade a system that has served us so well for one that has served others so poorly?" End quote. Wow, what a fantastic question. We'll come back to it throughout this segment. On the opposing side, Justice Scalia's dissent anticipated a 2024 Supreme Court which seems intent on degrading the wall of separation. In recent state and religion cases, the court has developed a history and tradition test akin to what Scalia suggested in his McCreary dissent. Quote, "With all of this reality and much more staring it in the face, how can the court possibly assert that, quote, the First Amendment mandates governmental neutrality between religion and non-religion, and that manifesting a purpose to favor adherence to religion generally is unconstitutional? Who says so? Surely not the words of the Constitution. Surely not the history and traditions that reflect our society's constant understanding of those words." End quote. I ask, which history and whose traditions? In the clip I played, Scalia listed several instances from the founding era which indicated government approval of religion. In his dissent, Scalia selected the events which supported his point. In fact, there are many events in history we could look to. We could look to chaplains in the Congress or the Treaty of Tripoli, which declared that the United States was not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. We could look to George Washington's prayer and fasting proclamation or Thomas Jefferson's refusal to issue one. Which history shall we use? In her concurring opinion, Justice O'Connor may have been thinking of Scalia's dissent when she wrote, quote, "It is true that the framers lived at a time when our national religious diversity was neither as robust nor as well recognized as it is now. They may not have foreseen the variety of religions for which this nation would eventually provide a home. They surely could not have predicted new religions, some of them born in this country. But they did know that line drawing between religions is an enterprise that, once begun, has no logical stopping point. They worried that the same authority which can establish Christianity in exclusion of all other religions may establish with the same ease any particular sect of Christians in exclusion of all other sects. The religion clauses, as a result, protect adherents of all religions, as well as those who believe in no religion at all." End quote. If a history and tradition test alone is our guide, how do we accommodate changing demographics and viewpoints? Which tradition and history do we use? Most of the founders were Protestant. Might a future court use the history and tradition test to disadvantage Scalia's Catholicism? In 2005, the majority also appealed to history, but in addition declined to endorse a public religious expression simply because some founders did so on occasions. This approach, O'Connor believed, protected the rights of, quote, adherents of all religions as well as those who believe no religion at all, end quote. Hi, I'm Warren Throckmorton, co-author with Michael Coulter of Getting Jefferson Right, Fact-Checking Claims About Thomas Jefferson. This is Telling Jefferson Lies, a podcast series about how history can be hijacked for ideological and political purposes. Initially, I focused on the unprecedented action of publisher Thomas Nelson to pull David Barton's book on Thomas Jefferson from publication due to historical errors. Since then, I have examined specific historical errors associated with Christian nationalism and the negative consequences of mixing church and state. In these final episodes, I want to give testimony to the virtues of the separation of church and state. This is episode 13, The O'Connor Question. Welcome to the beginning of the end of the Jefferson Lies series. I really enjoyed putting this on, and I hope you have gotten something out of it. If you've been with me from the start, you know that there have been two broad parts to the series. The first part involved me as a participant observer reporting on my work, fact-checking David Barton's Christian Nation stories. In the second part, I shifted to presenting my opinion about the problems of Christian nationalism. I realized that exposes a potential limitation. This series comes from my point of view. Although I interviewed 30 experts, I chose what to include from the interviews in the segments. I also asked them to be in the series because I liked what they had to say or had written. By the way, I want to express my thanks to every one of them. I had several purposes for this series. First, I wanted to tell the story behind Getting Jefferson Right and its role in how and why David Barton's Christian Nationalist book on Thomas Jefferson was pulled from publication. Then I wanted to advance the premise that Christian nationalism requires either a revision of history or the Constitution, or both. Finally, after some meandering around, I want to say what I believe when it comes to church and state. On that final point, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's question is the perfect jumping-off point. Let me read it again. Quote, "Those who would negotiate the boundaries between church and state must therefore answer a difficult question. Why would we trade a system that has served us so well for one that has served others so poorly?" End quote. Let that sink in. In that very short statement, O'Connor summed up my feelings on the subject as reflected in this series. Separation of church and state is an American innovation designed to address the flaws of a system which, quote, served others so poorly, end quote. Currently, I see separation of church and state being threatened in the United States. And this series is one of many efforts to ask why and say, hey, let's not trade the system that has served us so well. My belief is this. When it comes to the question of church and state, The U.S. was founded as a republic with no collective intention to officially favor Christianity. It seems to me that there are three possible responses to this premise. One is agreement. A second is that I'm correct on the history, but that the founders got it wrong and should have included reference to God and Christ in the charter documents. A third response is, no, Throckmorton, you're wrong. America was founded as a Christian nation. Some Christian nationalists throughout history and today take that view. The third response is what I've spent much of the first part of this series critiquing. Some Christian nationalists say that the nation is an actual covenant with God. Others say the Christian character is more symbolic or aspirational, but either way, Christian nationalists say the founders intended for America to be governed according to Christian principles and give preference to Christianity as a religion. I hope in prior episodes I've given you good reason to doubt the Christian nationalist storytelling behind that view. My aim in this segment is to affirm, with the help of expert testimony, that the United States was founded as a republic with the intention to keep church and state separate. The American venture into the separation of church and state was, and is, an experiment, but one which very religious founders decided to conduct based on their bad experience with establishments and their knowledge of the history of those establishments. You can find evidence to support both sides of this issue, but in the Constitution and Bill of Rights, the founders made their choice. Starting off is historian Charles Haynes, Senior Fellow for Religious Liberty at the Freedom Forum and First Amendment expert.
I would say that, unfortunately, a good number of Americans, I hope it's a minority, believe that separating church from state is the root cause of America's moral decline and all manner of social ills. And despite ample historical evidence to the contrary, they seem to strongly believe that the United States was founded as a Christian nation. And I know you addressed this with your listeners in another broadcast, so they understand that that's the belief out there. And they believe that the blessings of liberty are derived from our acknowledgement as a nation of God, by which, of course, they mean their God or their understanding of God. Reminds me of what James Dunn, the great religious liberty advocate and Baptist leader, used to say. He used to say, you know, Charles, the trouble with theocracy is everyone wants to be theo. And that's right. That's exactly the trouble historically and today. People think that it's their religion that needs to be at the helm and everyone else in the hatches.
Christian nationalist history typically teaches that the United States was founded to be a Christian Protestant republic. David Barton says the Constitution quotes the Bible verbatim. Many, including Barton, say the United States entered a covenant with God. But I have questions. Who represented the people at the covenant meeting? Who exactly did God meet with? In the Christian nationalist rendering of events, God didn't include the enslaved or the native people who actually inhabited the land. Instead, the Mayflower Compact or John Winthrop's sermon, A Model of Christian Charity, is often offered as evidence of the covenant. Let's stop a minute on Winthrop's sermon with its famous reference to a city on a hill. Historian Abram Van Ingen, in his book City on a Hill, A History of American Exceptionalism, has thoroughly documented how Harvard historians Perry Miller and Sack Van Berkovich decided to make Winthrop's sermon a model of Christian charity and the Puritan settlement the beginning of the real America. Rather than earlier settlements, Plymouth Rock or Jamestown, Miller originally and Berkovich following him crafted a persuasive narrative which placed Boston at the origin of America. According to Van Ingen, Miller and Berkovich went so far as to invent facts to elevate the status of the Winthrop sermon. Harvard historians stooping to wall builders' tactics? Say it ain't so. In Van Ingen's telling, he highlighted the work of Perry Miller to bring the Puritan story to America's schoolchildren. Miller wrote, quote, "Without some understanding of Puritanism, there is no understanding of America," end quote. Because of that belief in 1938, Miller wrote a history book which was widely used in American schools. Of course, the real evangelistic work was done by Ronald Reagan. although every president since Kennedy had previously referred to the sermon's invocation of America as a city on a hill, Reagan made it central to his vision of American exceptionalism. In this way, a sermon unremarkable in its time came to provide a usable past for a modern purpose. When it comes to the separation of church and state, not everybody agrees that Winthrop is the place to start.
For me, Roger Williams is still such a central character in this whole narrative. Roger Williams, of course, was a Puritan who very quickly ran afoul of the Puritan authorities in Massachusetts because he objected to the interleaving of church and state. And Roger Williams is also responsible for this metaphor that we use all the time. That is the separation of the garden of the church from the wilderness of the world by means of a wall of separation. Now, what's lost in that metaphor, seems to me, with our modern sensibilities, is the fact that Roger Williams and his contemporaries were not members of the Sierra Club. That is to say, they did not share our romantic notions about wilderness. Wilderness for them was a place of danger where evil lurked. And so when Roger Williams talks about separating the garden of the church from the wilderness of the world, he is eager to maintain the integrity of the faith, lest it be corrupted by too close an association with the state.
The actions of Williams and those who followed him to Rhode Island merit mention. Their first governmental agreement in 1837 was simple, but was relevant, quote, only in civil things, end quote. Let me read the entire agreement. Quote, "We whose names are hereunder, desirous to inhabit in the town of Providence, do promise to subject ourselves in active or passive obedience to all such orders or agreements as shall be made for public good of the body in an orderly way, by the major assent of the present inhabitants, masters of families, incorporated together into a town fellowship, and such others whom they shall admit unto them, only in civil things," end quote. The annals of the town of Providence commented, quote, "Here then was established a Christian community based upon the great principles of perfect religious liberty as contended for by Mr. Williams both at Salem and at Plymouth," end quote. Following that simple agreement was a more complex charter with a simple statement carrying forward the Pledge of Religious Freedom. The relevant clause in the 1640 Providence Agreement for a government was, quote, "We agree, as formerly hath been the liberties of the town, so still to hold forth liberty of conscience," end quote. There were 39 signers of that document, one of which I am proud to say was my ancestor, John Throckmorton. Why not use the Providence Agreement for a government as a founding document? Or why not Williams' book, The Bloody Tenet of Persecution? Winthrop's sermon has the rhetorical advantage, but arguably, the movement Williams started is the more American position when it comes to separation of church and state. As Randall Balmer notes, the framers had the example of Williams and Rhode Island, but also other mid-Atlantic states, which demonstrates that there was a parallel movement toward religious freedom developing alongside the old world of the Puritans and other states with religious establishments.
The story of the Puritans is so embedded in our national consciousness. And part of the narrative is that they were seeking religious freedom. Well, that's true, they were. But what complicates that narrative is that they wanted at the same time to deny religious freedom to everyone else. And that was part of the reason that Roger Williams was kicked out of Massachusetts, went to Rhode Island to establish there a haven of religious freedom and religious diversity. But that wasn't the only place in the colonies. If you look at New Amsterdam, New Netherland under the Dutch, which of course becomes New York after 1664, you have an extraordinary diversity of religious groups. You had the Dutch Reformed Church. You also had the Huguenots, the French Protestants. You had Catholics. You had Jews in New York after 1654. Presbyterians, Lutherans, you can go on and on. There's an extraordinary spectrum of religious diversity in the middle colonies, New York and New Jersey, and certainly in Pennsylvania as well under William Penn. And so one of the challenges facing the founders as they are trying to forge this new government is what to do with religion. Now, the traditional pattern had been to interlock religion with the political structure, with government. But the founders saw all of the problems with that back in the old world, England and in Europe, where you have these wars of religion. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to try something new. So part of the reason for that was the experience back in the old world, but also looking at the diversity already present in the Atlantic colonies. And they said, let's stay away from religion and let's let the government function separately from religion. And that was a radical idea at the time.
What if Miller and Berkovich had considered Roger Williams' Rhode Island the true American beginning, or at least considered the tension between coercion and religious freedom as a key struggle? What if they just reported what happened? According to Van Ingen, no one much cared about Winthrop's sermon with the city on a hill punchline until Miller became its hype man. If I was writing about the beginning of America, I would make it a drama involving the tension of ideas between Rhode Island and Massachusetts and feature Roger Williams and his compatriots on one side and Winthrop and the Puritans on the other. Williams and his followers came up with a distinctly American innovation, the separation of church and state, and implemented it in their government. Moving on to the founding era, Notre Dame University history professors emeritus Mark Knoll and George Marsden have reminded us in prior episodes that it is implausible to think America could be a Christian nation with such an unchristian beginning. According to Knoll and Marsden, historical research just doesn't support the Christian nation conclusion. They believe that in 1983, when they wrote Search for Christian America along with Nathan Hatch, and they believe it now. First, Mark Knoll, then George Marsden.
The conclusion was not that the founding of the United States was completely secular, not that it was dominated completely by 18th century Enlightenment thought, but that the Christian influence was one of many influences such that claiming that the United States was unusually or even uniquely Christian in its origin was just a historical mistake. So what we have in the book, quite a bit of evidence, and most of it, I think, I would maintain to this day. In particular, the fact that the primary ideology of the American Revolution was an ideology dominated by 18th century concerns about the way in which tyranny promotes vice, vice undercuts virtue, and the undercutting of virtue destroys liberty. Now, there are Christian contributions to that notion, and some of the good work that's come out subsequently. I'm thinking of a book by Nicholas Miller, who was one of my students at Notre Dame, but who convinced me that there were some strong dissenting Protestant contributions to the formulation of the First Amendment, for example. And there other historians have pointed out that there are traditions, particularly in Calvinist thought, of resistance to rulers that move toward tyranny. Yes, I want to include that. We have a little bit of that in the book. But to think that the founding of the United States was somehow uniquely or unusually or outstandingly Christian is just a mistake. The founding of the United States was due to as much conspiracy thinking, as much abuse of the Bible as good use of the Bible, as much demonization of opponents as it was honorable actions, and as much sheer hypocrisy as anything in the 18th century. There were a few people in England and actually a few in the American colonies who said, you Americans, you patriots, are worried about liberty. Well, good for you to worry about liberty. But why? Why, if you're so concerned about liberty, do you have hundreds of thousands of black slaves in the United States? Well, there was no answer to that question, except just to ignore it. And those kind of factors led us to conclude then, lead me to conclude now, that any serious attempt to understand the historical founding of the United States should recognize some Christian contribution, but should never think that the founding of the United States was uniquely or in a very special way a Christian enterprise.
This is a point that St. Augustine made back in the time of the Roman Empire, that he said, there's a city of God, which is the people that follow God and God's will and the way of Christ and the sacrificial, loving kind of ethic. And then there's the cities of the world, but they're all founded on displacing some, you know, previous civilization that was around, and by power and strength and violence, they enforce their will, and much of that will is controlled by selfishness. So, as far as I can see, just in principle, you can't say there is a normatively Christian nation that we should go back to. What you have instead is a interesting and sometimes frustrating mix of Christian ideas with things that are, you know, very, very much sub-Christian.
Another reason the U.S. didn't have a Christian beginning is due to the dehumanization of so many of God's children from the start. Historians Jamar Tisby and Troy Jackson call out Christian nationalist history for this weakness. First, Jamar Tisby, then Troy Jackson.
Follow the power. Whenever you're looking at history or theology, ask yourself, who does this empower? Who does this disempower? And I'm talking about the approach here. So in a person like David Barton, his approach to history, who does it empower? Who does it disempower? Whose stories does it tell? And how accurately? And to what effect? And so what's often the case, far right scholarship, if you want to call it that, is it's enshrining a status quo or trying to revive what they believed was a status quo in a bygone era. This is the whole spirit of make America great again. So there was a time in U.S. history when the United States was great, but follow the power. Great for whom is the question we must ask, which is always the immediate retort to make America great again. For whom was it great? Because it wasn't great for women, for black people, for LGBTQ people, for poor people. It's still not great. So then again, who does this help? Who does this empower? Namely, white men.
Barton has been doing this for decades. It's taking some quotes and some thin evidence to cast us as a fully Christian nation at our founding, and not recognizing the complexity of theological views at our founding, and also, to me, not really reckoning in any appreciable way with the racism and white supremacy that was so prominent in the compromise that was required to make this a union around slavery, the treatment of Native Americans, not just treatment, but genocide and forced removal of Native Americans. There is in our founding a woven tapestry of amazingly sublime ideas that were violated in thought and praxis from the get-go over and over again. So I think that becomes part of it. I think this rhetoric around make America great again, and I'm probably the millionth person to say this, really is elevating a mythical past that never really existed. Or if it did, it was for the few and largely white men.
Any history which makes the United States a nation with an exceptionally Christian beginning is incomplete and flawed. It is a white male history and not an accurate, complete one. But that is only one part of what I want to demonstrate. In fact, if you've come this far with me, I hope we're on the same page on that matter. It really isn't possible for a nation to be Christian, and even if it was possible, America didn't achieve it. But there is something more I want to say with the help from my guests. The majority of those who crafted and voted on the charter documents intended church and state to be separate in the federal government. Not everyone agreed about how that principle should be applied in every case, but when they voted for a system that prohibited a Christian republic. Charles Haynes says it better than I can.
Many Christian conservatives seem to seek to restore an America they think has been lost, that reflects their faith, their values. And in this view, the Supreme Court is the villain, has wrongly interpreted the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment to exile religion from public life and destroy the Christian ethos that has made America great, in their view. And they say separation of church and state, well, that's not even in the Constitution. You can't find it there. Now, that is, of course, not accurate, but that's what many Americans hear from the pulpit, and they believe. I guess they haven't read the Constitution recently, because, of course, even before we get to the First Amendment, Article 6 tells us that there can be no religious test for public office under the Constitution. And I think we've lost the sense of how radical and revolutionary that was to found a nation that could never be, if you will, a Christian nation or a Jewish nation or a Muslim nation. Why? Because you can't require that the leaders be of that particular faith. So you can't possibly establish a Christian nation with no religious test for office. And the founders at the Constitutional Convention understood that. They understood that if they put it in there, then Roman Catholics, which many of them feared at that time, could never establish a Catholic country. That was the point. Why many of them voted for it, actually.
Stop and think about that. In the ratification debates about the Constitution, this issue came up in several places. For instance, North Carolina delegate James Iredell defended the no religious test clause by saying the framers wanted to, quote, establish religious liberty in America, end quote. Iredell said, quote, I consider the cause under consideration as one of the strongest proofs that could be adduced that it was the intention of those who formed this system to establish a general religious liberty in America. But it is objected that the people of America may, perhaps, choose representatives who have no religion at all, and that pagans and Mahometans may be admitted into offices. But how is it possible to exclude any set of men without taking away that principle of religious freedom which we ourselves so warmly contend for? This is the foundation on which persecution has been raised in every part of the world. The people in power were always right and everybody else wrong. If you admit the least difference, the door to persecution is opened. End quote. Iredell was mindful that the United States might change in some future day, even if he hoped it would not happen. Quote, it is apprehended that Jews, Mahometans, pagans may be elected to high offices under the government of the United States. Those who are Mahometans or any others who are not professors of the Christian religion can never be elected to the office of president or other high office but in one of two cases. First, if the people of America lay aside the Christian religion altogether, it may happen. Should this unfortunately take place, the people will choose such men as think as they do themselves. Another case is, if any persons of such description should, notwithstanding their religion, acquire the confidence and esteem of the people of America by their good conduct and practice of virtue, they may be chosen. I leave it to the gentleman's candor to judge what probability there is of the people choosing men of different sentiments from themselves. End quote. Reading that is almost more sanity than I can bear. Citizens in the new nation were generally aware of the persecution in the old world and in some parts of the new world where there were established churches in their states. There was a growing desire for religious liberty throughout the new nation, and the Constitution and Bill of Rights reflected that sentiment, even if every vestige of religious establishment didn't fade away immediately. By the way, Iredell eventually became a Supreme Court justice. In addition to being a justice, he may have been a bit of a prophet, as Rob Boston, communications director with Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, reminds us by paraphrasing Thomas Jefferson.
I always love the famous quote of his, but when he was reflecting on the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom and how its protections went beyond Christianity. It protected the Jew and the Gentile, the Hindu, the Mohammedan, the infidel of every denomination. You can't look at a quote like that and square that with Christian nationalists. A Christian nationalist did not say that thing. That is somebody who has a broad liberal view of religious freedom and, fascinatingly, anticipated the America that we would become.
Okay, back to history with Dr. Haynes.
Then we get to the First Amendment, and then it's explicitly laid out what kind of nation we're meant to be. It's not unclear. There's only 16 words, and they're very clear. And the Establishment Clause, the first clause of the First Amendment, bars government from any law doing anything respecting. And by that, the framers meant having to do with establishing religion. And this is exactly what separation of church and state is. It's the very definition of it. So the Establishment Clause is separation of church and state. So by prohibiting the federal government at that time, and then later prohibiting the states under the 14th Amendment, prohibiting the government from entanglement with religion, the United States broke with the precedents of history to create a secular republic that would protect religions from governmental interference and protect the state from religious domination. So no establishment, separation of church and state, is, I would argue, one of America's greatest contributions to humanity. Because entanglement of church and state has been a leading cause of violence and oppression throughout history. And this remains true in many parts of the world today. And that's why Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, like Roger Williams before them in Rhode Island, defined true religious liberty as requiring two principles. Two, no establishment, getting the government out of the religion business, and free exercise of religion, ensuring that people of all faiths or no faith were free in matters of faith, to choose in matters of faith. Together, they believed that these two principles would give us one freedom, religious freedom or liberty of conscience. More deeply, religious freedom is, of course, liberty of conscience. For people who may believe in God or may not, or may have any number of deep convictions, it protects their right to have those convictions and practice them. So as a result, the United States has been spared largely from the endless cycle of holy wars that have caused rivers of blood to flow throughout history. And I would say thanks largely to the religion clauses of the First Amendment, religious freedom or liberty of conscience has thrived in the United States. You know, despite our flaws, and we have them, and we've had dark chapters in our history concerning religious oppression, but despite those flaws and despite the work that's still to be done because the playing field is not yet level for everyone, but despite those things, this country is today, I would argue, the boldest and most successful experiment in religious freedom the world has yet seen.
The historical point I want to make is that there was an old way and a new way, and gradually the new way won out. In broad terms, Williams and his Rhode Island pioneers started the fire, followed by several other states, as Balmer said. Then the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom in 1786 was passed. Then Article 6 of the Constitution came along. Then the First Amendment, and by 1833, state establishment gave up the ghost in Massachusetts. Even though there were many people who wanted more Christianity in the federal government, when the founders all got together and crafted rules to live by, they gave us separation of church and state. Having satisfied myself and a good many listeners that separation of church and state is good history, I realize the doubters among us will not be able to get those George Washington and John Adams quotes out of their minds. Establishing that even the religious founders thought that separation was a good idea doesn't mean that everybody agreed and it was all settled. As Randall Balmer reminded us in a previous episode, the Christian nation urge has never gone away. We need to hear this again.
When religious groups, particularly Christians, feel under siege or there is a crisis in the nation, they tend to flee towards some form of Christian nationalism. During the War of 1812, Timothy Dwight, president of Yale, lamented the fact that the founders had refused to or neglected to include some reference to Christianity in our charter documents. During the Civil War, the Confederacy was criticizing the United States Constitution because it contained no references to Christianity as being the basis for the founding of the nation. And so there's a movement called the National Reform Association that drafts an amendment to the Constitution to designate the United States as a Christian nation. Abraham Lincoln refused to act on that. After the school prayer decisions of the early 1960s, there's another effort to designate the United States as a Christian nation, and it even has the support of Everett Dirksen, the venerable Republican senator from Illinois, who proclaimed that he was positively evangelistic about this effort to make the United States into a Christian nation. At each point of crisis in American history, there have been these efforts to declare that the United States is a Christian nation. And I think we're seeing that again today. There's a sense on the part of many people of faith, and many of them are sincere about it. Some, I think, are not so sincere, but others are sincere about it. And they are saying the only way to save the republic, the only way to save our nation is to make these sorts of declarations. History, I think, has proven them wrong about that. That is to say, the United States functions best as a multicultural society.
This is where we find ourselves today. Although different issues consume us and we fuss in different ways, over social media instead of through pamphlets and newspapers, we are still debating the best relationship for the church and the state. As I reflect on this, I can't help but think of Justice O'Connor's challenge to Justice Scalia. At the same time, I call on us all to get our history right. I realize correct history is often in the eye of the beholder. One problem with using history and tradition as a sole guide for deciding appropriate church-state separation is the fact that history can be quote-mined and selectively cited. Scalia did it in his dissent. Those on both sides of this issue can find quotes and events from the founding era which support them. For instance, what would Scalia say to James Madison, who wrote the following to the Reverend Jasper Adams in September of 1833? Madison said, quote, "I must admit, moreover, that it may not be easy in every possible case to trace the line of separation between the rights of religion and the civil authority with such distinctness as to avoid collisions and doubts on unessential points. The tendency to an usurpation on one side or the other, or to a corrupting coalition or alliance between them, will be best guarded against by entire abstinence of the government from interference in any way whatsoever. Beyond the necessity of preserving public order and protecting each sect against trespasses on its legal rights by others." End quote. Furthermore, the past is full of apparent contradictions. For instance, George Washington called for a day of Thanksgiving and Thomas Jefferson did not. Who will be our model? I submit we need a principle grounded in our charter documents, and to my eye, it seems like there are two broad perspectives. One is that church and state should stay separate, and the other is that they may mix. In my opinion, the American innovation of separating church and state has a lot to recommend it when one considers the alternative. There may be flaws and some problems to address, as Madison said, but it sure beats the alternative. In this, I agree with Sandra Day O'Connor. And that's the general message of this series. David Barton and Stephen Wolfe are particular cases, but there's a whole world of Christian nationalists out there who want some level of establishment or preferential treatment of Christianity. In my view, this is dangerous and threatens the Republic as conceptualized in our charter documents. Separation of church and state is good history, and in the final episode to come, I explore what's good about separation for the church and the state. Today's closing song is Twisting History by Jonas Fair. Telling Jefferson Lies theme song is The World Awaits Us All by Roman Candle. Tune in to them wherever you listen to digital music. The series is written and produced by yours truly and brought to you by the second edition of Getting Jefferson Right, which I co-wrote with Grove City College political science professor Michael Coulter. See the show notes for more information and credits. The regular series will end today, but watch for occasional bonus episodes, which I plan to post indefinitely. So it's still a good idea to subscribe. I also plan to post my entries from my blog, The Throckmorton Initiative, in a podcast format starting in May. See the show notes to find out how to subscribe for free. If you like the podcast, give us a lovely rating. And as always, thanks for listening.